Hello.
It's good to talk to you. I wanted to spend a little time this week talking about how to write a 1,000-word essay draft, which is a task we're all going to be doing shortly. There are a couple of other things that we can get to in this time, but that's the most important, and I want to start there straight away. 1,000 words is good length because it is far too short for any bullshit. In order to write a 1,000-word essay, you need to know precisely what your idea is and precisely how to communicate it, and there's no possibility of hiding anything behind little florets of stuff that's neither right nor wrong. We could give a technical content to the word bullshit, as the philosopher Harry Frankfurt famously did, but for the moment, let us concentrate not on the negative but on the positive. The task of writing a 1,000-word essay is the task of communicating one idea clearly, with both an indication of its origin and of its implications, and in such a form as to leave the reader additional work that she can do herself in understanding the consequences of this idea of yours for her. The other value of learning to write clearly and forcefully in 1,000 words is that every form of writing that you will do professionally will be available as units of 1,000 words that you have clearly and forcefully strung together. Whether we're talking about a brief, which has formal sections, or an opinion piece, or for that matter, some form of, quote, legal scholarship, unquote, like a law review article or a note, the number of 1,000-word units, 10, 11, 12, 4, 6, is really irrelevant to the discipline of writing each of those units clearly and forcefully and connecting them in a fashion which keeps the reader's mind pressing alongside yours as you go. So, what we need in order to write a good 1,000-word draft, which, under the circumstances of the evaluation policy in force, should be a bad 1,000-word draft, a matter we'll come back to in a moment. In order to write a good, bad first 1,000-word draft, you need an idea. The idea isn't mine, it's not assigned, it doesn't belong to a client or to anybody else, it belongs to you. The idea is the fruit of your education. Education in the true sense, something brought out of yourself in response to what you have been through and what you have learned. The idea is undoubtedly one of a number of ideas that have been brought out of you by education and experience in the course of the first tiny bit more than one half of law school. We have already identified the unique quality of the first term of law school. It is language learning by immersion in law talk. You are now conversant in law talk, but there are no doubt things that came up in the course of that important effort to acquire law talk, which left behind questions of all sorts, ideas you had, for which, in the process of storming your way through law talk and misunderstanding what was going to happen on the exams, you didn't have time to think about fully. Now you do. Of course, there's another class of ideas altogether, which also might be the ideas surrounding your essays. That is, well, you. Even under ordinary circumstances, which of course these aren't, writing about oneself when first given an opportunity to pick a subject in law school is quite frequent. I wouldn't put the proportion numerically. You can look in the archived material of this course and see for yourself the frequency. I feel more concerned with the intensity of people's need to write about themselves, which is perfectly understandable and entirely okay. Your ideas, stimulated by your own personal experience in the course of the first half of law school, are fine to write about. Though the idea that after a few weeks of law school you know how to fix law school, which is a prevailing sentiment most of the time, and particularly prevailing this year, I think this is because not only don't you know how to fix law school, but nobody knows how to fix law school. So everybody feels extremely competent to declare. But whatever it is that is your idea brought about by your experience of law school, it requires the same filtration and clarification that an idea about contracts or crimes would require. That is to say, you're trying to distill it to its essence. This, whatever it is my idea, whether about myself or about the law or about the process of learning it, this is my idea. And generally speaking, an idea which is ripe for the development into an essay draft at 1,000 words is an idea that you can put in a sentence. A sentence, after all, is the grammatical carrier of an idea in our human languages. And so it's reasonable to say that in a simple sentence, you can express forcefully the idea which is your essay. Generally speaking, that sentence which is the idea of the essay should appear in the first few words of it, in the first paragraph. It's probably what the eighth grade teacher called the topic sentence of the paragraph, but it needn't be, because there is such a thing as counterpoint in musical making. And there is such a thing as counterpoint in the way we use our language to make things happen in other people's minds. But close to the first sentence of one's draft is one's idea. Certainly a reader ought not to have completed the first paragraph without knowing what the idea is. If the reader doesn't know, why should he keep reading? Subsequently, there are several hundred words likely to be devoted to the fleshing out of this idea, its development. Whether we're thinking in terms of the development of a theme in sonata form, or we're thinking about the development of the impulse that makes a poem, or whether we're thinking about the development of an argument in an appellate brief, development means a number of different things simultaneously or interspersedly. One thing development means is showing how an idea is made, where it comes from. This isn't, generally speaking, a matter of name-dropping or authority, though in brief writing and similar tasks, of course, authority is available and must be used. That isn't necessarily true in any of the other forms that you might be writing at 1,000 words, from a newspaper column to a letter to a person whose influence you wish to use. The nature of the how I came by the idea, however, is likely to be of some interest to a reader who wants to follow your thought. Similarly, an idea is developed by showing how it contrasts with or joins to other ideas, that is, putting the idea you have in conversation. This requires one of the important tasks in caring for an idea, which is understanding how to use it, how to move its moving parts, how to make the idea function in relation to other ideas through the medium of words. And of course, because this is law school, there are objections to ideas. And it is sometimes, often perhaps, useful to show how you dispose of this objection or two that you think important. Not the objections that are quibbles that you can simply word yourself carefully to avoid, but the objections that are real, the ones that are challenges to your thinking and which you welcome, because it is in the process of dialogue with other ideas that your idea becomes fuller and more resonant, and one hopes more useful to the reader who is acquiring the idea from you. Having done what is necessary to develop the idea, necessary is the form in which we greet words when we are working under a reasonably stringent guideline. I write at roughly this length, professionally an awful lot. Michi and I publish a good deal of material in the World Press at roughly this length, where indeed it may be very much the editor's point of view that the hole they have for what we have to say is 700 words or 900 words or 1,000 words, and sometimes a draft at 1,200 feels like the right bad first draft to make. But of course, it is a bad first draft, and by the time it isn't a bad first draft anymore, it has used only the necessary words. When you have used the necessary words to develop your idea, you have still room for a conclusion. The conclusion is surely closely related to the idea that was announced at the beginning of the essay, but it isn't the same because things have happened in the meantime using the words you used. And the most effective way in which the conclusion can express itself is not only by showing again the importance of the idea from which you began, but by showing the reader that she now possesses enough material, including your idea, to use your idea further, to take the implications you have expressed in the development and to infer from those implications new ideas of her own. The most effective essay, after all, whether we are thinking about Montaigne's way of doing it or Stephen Jay Gould's way of doing it, the most effective essay is the one which starts the process of thinking, not the process of concluding it, and which moves in the important companionship between the author and the reader, from the author to the reader, such that at the end, the impetus given by the essay to thinking is no longer the author's thinking, but the reader's thinking. Then it is good. But the first draft ought to be bad. See, a bad first draft is the only kind of thing that can make a good second draft possible. You are a perfectionist, as I am. We are the risk-averse control freaks who went to law school. You can attempt to hold the essay in your head until it's perfect. You can polish every sentence, remove every unnecessary word, make the paragraphs flow more beautifully, all without ever putting a pencil to a pad or a bit on a screen. You can. A 1,000-word essay needs to be outlined. The template that you will get when you click on the first essay page to make your own, the way you made your journal, the template you will get will have dummy headings in it, properly formatted for the wiki, in order to remind you that one really good way of submitting a draft to the readers and the editor on the wiki is to put your outline in the course of the piece itself as the headings, so that the structure of the draft is clear to you and the reader in the same way at the same time using the same words. But whether you choose to use the outline as part of the essay draft itself, the outline is crucial. Maybe you know how to write a 50,000-word object without an outline. I shan't tell you whether you do or not, but I shall tell you this. If you want to write forcefully, effectively, economically, and in a catchable, contagious way, because, of course, your essay is intended to be contagious, it contains an idea you wish to put in community circulation. If you want to write that way, add 1,000 words without any bullshit, you need an outline. And that outline, of course, can be contained in your head. It's a few simple stages. at the top level, one, two, or three, at the next level, two or three per top level, one, etc. You understand. Its job is to show you from paragraph to paragraph how you mean to move. The map, not in the sense that a law review article has a map, in part one I do this, in part two I do that, in part three I don't do anything but, a map that a reader could find useful instead of tedious. But here again, of course, we come up against the pervading reality of the unreality of the psychic cruciality of, quote, grades, close quote. You've read the evaluation policy. You know that three qualities are measured multiple times through the course: effort, commitment, and improvement. They are measured at each draft of each essay, and they are measured overall against the performance of a term. How much effort, how much commitment, how much improvement, and in the weighting of those qualities that are measured in some ridiculous quantity that can be put into some ridiculous formula that can produce a ranked output that can be made into a grade, all that subsequent synthetic crap, improvement weights more heavily even than effort and commitment, which are important, but improvement is education at work. So, if you really wanted to maximize the quality of the work for the purpose of getting a good grade, you would have an abysmal first draft and a terrific second draft. That would be the broadest possible span of improvement. You won't be able to let yourself do that because you're risk-averse control freaks, and handing in something bad is a terrifying failure. Though, of course, really, I mean, if you truly wanted to practice the religion of grades, that's how you do it. Isn't it? But at any rate, the reason that we write bad first drafts is that they exist. Once you have written the bad first draft of anything, then all that's left is making it better, bit by bit, in as many drafts as required. Once upon a time, there was a very good lawyer. He was a man of skill and distinction. He was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He came from the family that owned the greatest toy store in New York, the one on Fifth Avenue, over now where the Trump Tower, well, whatever that's going to be called next, is. So he had an easy life and an excellent education. He was a superb fellow in his work as corporation counsel of the city of New York in public service, and as a partner at Cravath, Swain & Moore when I was there as a kid. His name, if you didn't rebus it out already from his pieces of New York City history, was Frederick Otto Augustus Schwartz IV, known as Fritz. And Fritz Schwartz, as a law firm partner, had value. Working with Fritz in a rotation was a good thing to do in my sense of how he helped to bring his lawyers along. But he had a maddening quality also. When associates submitted a draft of a something, a brief, a complaint, or whatever, to Fritz, it had a tendency to come back in the morning empty of any markings except across the top of the first page where it would be written, "Make this better." Fritz considered that to be the only instruction really necessary to give lawyers. And lawyers, at any rate, the lawyers whose futures seemed to depend upon his favor, resented that deeply. But, of course, that is, from his point of view, what had to happen with early drafts of things. They simply had to become better. I will avoid, generally speaking, unless I'm having a really off day, I will avoid, as an editor, simply pointing out that things need to be made better. I will attempt to hold up my end of the bargain about editing by explaining what, in my view, would be the route to making things better at whatever level of specificity I can or wish to provide, but things that exist in a bad first draft are well on their way to being good, because all that needs to happen is for them to improve. Things for which no bad first draft yet exists, on the other hand, are only speculatively ever likely to become good, because they haven't started by being bad. You will therefore begin with an idea which you will improve and sharpen, or rather polish in your mind, like a pebble carried in the pocket and massaged between the finger and the thumb for some while before ever being given to anybody else to see. And having looked out the window enough about your idea, the next step is an outline, and after that, a bad first draft, which can go in the wiki, and which can be edited by you and me and anybody else who cares to drop by, unless you've chosen to make the essay, like the journal, private only to you and me. But there will be at least two of us sawing away on it, and then there will be at least a second draft, and it will be better. And upon the effort, the commitment, and the improvement represented in that process, something useless called a grade will then be, I don't know, likely to reflect the best possible version of the little bit of judgment that can be applied to the process of making a thing clear in a couple of drafts. The idea of your first essay is the one that you need now. The idea of your second essay you will need when you get there. I don't see much purpose in advancing. I do see purpose, however, in choosing different things to have ideas about, and different kinds of ideas written about in different ways. Somewhere down the road, in a term or two or three, there's going to come some moment at which you want to ask me to write on your behalf, to explain to someone, probably an employer, but possibly even somebody you mean to practice with, to explain who you are in my experience of you, this thing called a recommendation letter. One of the ways, of course, in which one thinks about a person one is recommending is to think about the breadth of what one knows about the way their minds work and the way their writing functions. And the more breadth you have offered, the more breadth can be ascribed to you in the process of writing about what I know. I should like, of course, to know more than simply what two essays were. But two essays and two drafts on two ideas you had yourself and carried to development according to your own way of thinking are far better as guides to what ought to be said about you than a set of blue books on stereotypic questions, cliché in nature, offered under circumstances which largely prevented any conversation or mutuality of understanding. So, that is how to write a 1,000-word essay as best I can help you to understand it. You have before you in the wiki, in archived material, a comprehensive set of such things written by students occupying the position in the place you now occupy, minus the epidemic, and all the comments that I made on all the drafts and all the redrafting that they did, and you could spend an exhaustive amount of time reading in there and trying to understand how to game the system, or you could just have an idea. One of the things we are discussing with respect to law practice at the moment is the difference between having a practice in which it is your ideas that drive your work and having a job in which the ideas of the clients filtered through the intentions of the partners as understood by the needs of the business, which is the law firm, are the lines within which you color more or less and within which your being is mostly had. I have made no secret of the fact that I consider my job to be offering as early in the law school process as is practicable, that is, right after you get done learning law talk by immersion, trying to bring out of you what you think yourself about what it means to be a lawyer. Not as you thought before you arrived in law school, but not as you thought in law school only without regard to the person that you were before you got here. Rather, in the form we call change, in which human beings both continue to reflect the psychic structures that evolved with them through early childhood and into life, and the experiences that cause us to adapt. In this context, I do want to come back just for a moment to something that has already happened, to our discussion yesterday on the pad concerning a comment of Carl Wiley's that if you really thought about it, when you're doing a deal, you'd recognize that the deal you're doing will cause thousands of people and their families to be hurt. In the discussion of this comment of Wiley's on the pad, I found myself puzzled by a form of argument which seemed to suggest that unless everything a lawyer does results in Pareto superior social outcomes, outcomes in which everybody is better off and nobody is worse off, then the lawyer has confronted the same ethical and political quandary that is posed by knowing that the deal you're working on will hurt thousands of people and their families, and it's really all the same, and so unless we could practice law without ever harming another living thing, then it's really all the same and it doesn't matter what we do. I thought this argument was puzzling, first of all, because I didn't understand its relevance. The important point in the context of something split, and in the context of our larger conversation in this course, is not that lawyers are put in a position where they must dissociate the negative consequences of what they do. In this respect, it is true that lawyers are people, and people have to do that. That's how human minds work. So the question isn't whether that will have to happen from time to time in our lives. We do have to dissociate our traumas, whatever they are. And what we were looking at in the poet's eye, and I hoped in our own, was not that some lawyer somewhere is dissociating, but rather an understanding of the psychological mechanisms as they interact with the substance of a practice. And to that, the point that law practices, like other social action, have consequences, and not all consequences are positive in the view of the actor, that is both tautological and rudimentarily informative. It's the next steps after that which are interesting and important. So, what do we do about that? This I found puzzling because it was presented in the alternative of, well, you can always just quit the job, which again is tautological and to some extent informative, but unless we think of a lawyer's career as primarily involving a sequence of quit jobs, which I don't, it's a little bit, again, sort of aside the point. So what would the point be? Well, the point would be, as I have tried to suggest before and tediously will again, that in law school one should learn how to build a law practice for oneself which meets one's intellectual, material, moral, and political requirements. In the context of that inquiry, the discovery that which is not altogether and completely, every single moment of every single day, devoted to Pareto superior outcomes is therefore the same because people get hurt, doesn't really help. One writer suggested on the pad that perhaps we ought to understand that it's okay to do harm to thousands of people and their families if in doing so you are securing the material needs of your own family. And if that's the point of view from which one begins to start a practice, I have no problem with teaching how to build a practice. This is law school. My job isn't to determine what your moral preferences are, and our conversation isn't actually for the purpose of altering anybody's moral needs, or political needs, or material needs, or intellectual needs. My goal, after all, as a teacher, is to make more accessible, more intellectual possibilities out of which the intellectual needs of your practice might be founded. My own practice, as I currently perform it, that practice which is about free software, technological liberty, and the freedom of thought in a technological society, is the fruit of a lot of the thinking of my youth, from the time I began working as a computer programmer at 14 for money, and the time when, as a young law professor, understanding that I had won the lottery and could do in my practice what I wanted to do with the comfort of an academic job that soon I would be tenured in and which brought with it the opportunities to collaborate and learn that a university professorship brings, I began to try to think through how am I going to affect the continuity of freedom of thought against the dangers of a technologically enabled society. Over the course of the last 15 years, building the teaching practice that was the Software Freedom Law Center, I got the money necessary to pay these lawyers to learn from big companies that do all kinds of things, some of which we might consider to be hurting people. And sometimes I was engaged in contentious behavior, disputing, as Laura Nader, the great anthropologist of not law in the last 50 years would say, and in disputing, people get hurt. Sometimes my clients, let alone my adversaries. But what I did not have to do was to think at any time in the course of all those years and all those millions of dollars that what I was doing was incautiously, indifferently, or massively harmful to people whom I had no duty to a client to harm in any way. The collaterals, the bulk of the society within which whatever it was that I was doing was going on. I didn't have to quit the job. Sometimes I had to sever a relationship with a client or with a donor. That's not the same as quitting the job. That's the same as rebudgeting the practice. I filed a brief in January of 2019, amicus curiae, in the United States Supreme Court in a case known as Google against Oracle. My position in that case, as in many predecessor cases about subjecting software APIs to copyright, stretching back to Lotus against Borland in 1996, is that copyright law should not cover the APIs of computer programs for a variety of reasons, which I have tediously explained to the Supreme Court more than once, as I say. Oracle did not appreciate the position being taken in my brief. And this year, as the matter moved towards adjudication in the court, and as the Supreme Court indicated an interest in the position I had taken in the amicus brief by asking the parties on the merits to file additional letter briefs addressing the question that our brief raised, I take it that Oracle's willingness to continue helping me to fund my practice disappeared. Mr. Ellison burnt up a $200,000 invoice sitting on his desk from us and has indicated that our lengthy, decade-long relationship is over. Google, on the other hand, is not a donor to my charitable practice, and indeed I don't solicit or wish to accept Google money. So having made Oracle unhappy didn't make it possible for me instead to say to Google, well, why don't you put up the dough? They won't, I won't, it's not going to happen. That's a substantial chunk of income lost to my practice, and at a time when, in the middle of the epidemic, the most important thing in my practice is to save the jobs of the people who work there, to make sure that nobody loses wages or, in the savagery of the United States, health insurance, in the middle of this terrible crisis. And so there are souls here in the United States and in India, and their families, if they have families who depend upon them for support, whose livelihood I need to save. Losing support to the extent that Larry Ellison and Oracle generously previously supported us is a serious problem, but it's not a serious enough problem to make me wish that I hadn't told the Supreme Court what I think in the case, because I did what I believe is right. I was meeting there the intellectual and moral and political needs that I have in my practice. If it had a material negative consequence, well, it's my practice and I can steer it. It's not about quitting the job. And it's not about saying, well, okay, let's just do whatever it is that isn't quite right, but as close to right as we can in order to keep the money that we need. It's about being an adult, running a practice built to meet the intellectual, material, moral, and political needs of the lawyer who founded it, and of the partner with whom he works in it. This is a great privilege. In the society in which we live, indeed in human societies free and quasi-free and unfree, it is very rare to have the sufficiency of social capital and intellectual opportunity to build what meets your intellectual, material, moral, and political needs in life. Most people can't aspire to that. You can. You will have an excellent law license and potentially very good training behind that license very soon in a very wealthy society, which will accord you a good deal of respect and allow you to make it your way. Almost everybody listening to me right now is already coming up with reasons why you shouldn't. And many, many people, unfortunately, will obey those reasons. And after a third of a century of teaching many thousand lawyers, I have to prepare us both for the disappointment that is likely to result. But it is better for you, in your own growth, intellectual, professional, and personal, it is better for you in your own growth to accept the reality of that challenge and not to find reasons to decline it. Soon you will have the opportunity to build a law practice that meets your intellectual, material, moral, and political needs. If you use law school wisely and well, you will go out into the world not only with the privilege of trying that exercise, but with the understandings of various sorts and the skills necessary to achieve the goal. Reasons not to achieve the goal are reasons you should leave behind you. Step right up. Step right up.
the bottom. Everyone's a winner, bargains galore. That's right, you two can be the proud owner. The quality goes in before the name goes on. One-tenth of a dollar, one-tenth of a dollar. We got service after the sale. How about perfume? We got perfume. How about an engagement ring? Some for the little lady, some for the little lady, some for the little lady. $3-4. We got a year-end clearance. We got our white sale and a smoke-damaged furniture. You can drive it away today. Act now, and receive as our gift. Our gift to you, they come in all colors, one size fits all. No muss, no fuss, no spills, you tired of kitchen drudgery, everything must go. Going out of business, going out of business, going out of business sale. 50% off original retail price, skip the middle man. Don't settle for less, how do we do it, how do we do it? Volume, volume, turn up the volume. Now you heard it advertised, don't hesitate. Don't be caught with your drawers down. Don't be caught with your drawers down. You can step right up. Step right up. That's right, it fillets and chops, dice and slices. Never stops, lasts a lifetime, mows your lawn. And it mows your lawn and it picks up the kids from school. It gets rid of unwanted facial hair. It gets rid of embarrassing age spots. It delivers a pizza. And it lengthens. And it strengthens. And it finds that slipper that's been at large under the chaise lounge for several weeks. And it plays a mean rhythm master. It makes excuses for unwanted lipstick on your collar. And it's only a dollar. Step right up. It's only a dollar. Step right up. Cause it forges your signature. Not completely satisfied. Mail back unused portion of product for complete refund of price of purchase. Step right up. Please allow 30 days for delivery. Don't be fooled by cheap imitations. You can live in it. Living it, laughing it, loving it, swimming it, sleeping it, living it, swimming it, laughing it, loving it. Removes embarrassing stains from contour sheets. That's right. And it entertains visiting relatives. It turns a sandwich into a banquet. Tired of being the life of the party. Change your shorts, change your life. Change your life. Change into a 9-year-old Hindu boy. Get rid of your wife. And it walks your dog. And it doubles on sacks. Doubles on sacks. You can jump back, Jack. See you later, alligator. See you later, alligator. And it steals your car. It gets rid of your gambling debts. It quits smoking. It's a friend. It's a companion. It's the only product you will ever need. Follow these easy assembly instructions. It never needs ironing. Well, it takes weights off hips, bust, thighs, chin, midriff. Gives you dandruff. And it finds you a job. It is a job. And it strips the phone company free. Takes enterprise exchange. And it gives you denture breath. And you know it's a friend. And it's a companion. And it gets rid of your traveler's checks. It's new, it's improved, it's old-fashioned. Well, it takes care of business. Never needs binding, never needs binding, never needs binding. Gets rid of blackheads, heartbreakers, psoriasis. Christ, you don't know the meaning of heartbreak, buddy. Come on, come on. Come on, come on. Cause it's effective, it's defective. It creates household odors. It disinfects, it sanitizes for your protection. Gives you an erection, it wins the election. Why put up with painful corns any longer? It's a redeemable coupon, no obligation, no salesman will visit your home. We got a jackpot, jackpot, jackpot. Prizes, 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 all work guaranteed. How do we do it? 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 We need your business. We're going out of business. We'll give you the business. Get on the business end of our going out of business sale. Receive our free brochure. Free brochure. Read the easy to follow assembly instructions. Batteries not included. Send before midnight tomorrow. Terms available. Step right up. Step right up. Step right up. You got it, buddy. A large print giveth and a small print taketh away. Step right up. You can step right up. You can step right up. Come on, step right up. Step right up. Step right up. Step right up. Come on, come on, come on. Come on, come on. Step right up.
Art Leff's Swindling and Selling is the first of the materials I hope to use to demonstrate a lawyer's theory of social action in action. Art Leff was a creative legal thinker. I met him on his deathbed almost in my first term of law school when my teacher Robert Cover took me to meet his dearest friend Art Leff, who was dying of bone cancer at 42. Leff was the author of a law review article that impressed law professors quite a lot. You might have read it on the Emperor's New Clause and UCC 2202 and the theory of unconscionability, which lifted Leff from the obscurity of the Washington University Law School to Yale in a bound. But as you can tell from reading his writing, Art Leff was creative in the sense that irony requires. He had both presence and absence, and he was both present at Yale while he lived and absent from the pomposity that had raised him to his eminence because of his excellence in law review thought. He did write for law reviews now and again, even after that, book reviews and other things. In his last year, he was at work on a law dictionary because, of course, everything is made of words, and the meanings and histories of words are the content of the culture. And in between, there was swindling and selling. You see in Leff's collage, the one about him, which he makes the joke on the Dartmouth College case at the end of his introduction, you see in Leff's collage what we would call consilient reasoning, the effort to turn both microeconomic theory of the firm and Erwin Goffman's role theory in social psychology to the task of explaining how it is that bargains in the world really get done. It's interesting to think about Leff's understanding of that spot where the line of supply and demand cross like gently handled camels in the desert against the background of Carl Wiley's sense of the infinite plenitude of chaos that is the making of the kinds of deals in which Carl Wiley sits on the shoulders of the bankers who deal the cards and sweep the table. For what Leff, after all, wishes to point out is that at the end of the day, the bargain, the deal, the let's get this done, we'll both be better offishness of certain kinds of human behavior rises not from the rationality of the meaning of the minds in contracts only. It also arises from the gullibility of the mark and the shrewdness of the con, or maybe it's the other way around. But what it is ultimately is a form of phenomenon in social action which does not analytically differentiate between the contracts that are good and the swindles that are bad. You could think of this in part as another outgrowth of Holmes' point about the difference between moral and legal words, but it's far more than that. It's the beginning of a recognition that what it is that legal phenomena evolve out of isn't driven by logic and it isn't driven by morality. It's driven by the fact that human beings are the beings involved. And that if we want to understand how legal phenomena occur, social forces as they are, in Felix Cohen's analytical phrase, we also are always and at all times close to the human. This, after all, is part of what Franz Kafka means in the phrase that you have questioned since Robinson brought it up. I'm a lawyer. I am never far from evil. Suppose we began by saying we are never far from human frailty, from the inadequacy of theories of human choice that assume that there is consciousness only, And from the recognition that in the bulk of the human mental activity, which is unconscious, there lies all darkness as well as all light. To understand Leff's ruminations on his ideas about swindling and selling, about contracting, about how at the human level, moment by moment, in the little dramas of ordinary social life, deals get done. Whether that's the Spanish prisoner or the spike or the Squaresville pitch, whether it is Calvinist causation or it is the eminence of grace abounding, we can find in the human structures of thought and dream and impulse and desire, and in the social structuring that results from the influence of such minds upon other minds, the reality that the language of the law drapes and conceals and flatters and denies. Talk to you later.